High on a hill in Johannesburg stands a site that is nearly as old as the city itself. Today, it is a beacon for South Africa's democracy, but for most of its history, it has been the backdrop of a desperate fight for survival and dignity against impossible odds. Welcome to Constitution Hill. You're listening to Exploring Constitution Hill, a series that shines a light on one of South Africa's most iconic places, digging up untold stories.
Early hours of the morning, when the police kicked the doors and they were looking for me, and I was right there.
Bringing the history to life and figuring out what it all means.
That had been the place of domination and control. Transforming that pain, the oppression, into hope for the future would be a marvelous sight.
Two streets away from my home, there were soldiers. Two streets from behind my home, two streets from the front of my home, there were soldiers. Soldiers around my home. They were like coming to fetch this big terrorist. And believe you me, they were coming to fetch a 16-year-old child.
The year is 1976. The 16-year-old child in question is Seth Mazibuko, and he has managed to evade apartheid police for about a year. But now they've tracked him down to his family home in Orlando East, Johannesburg.
I laugh at this, you know, because they asked me, as Seth Mazibuko, they asked me, where is Seth Mazibuko? Where is Seth Mazibuko? Where is Seth Mazibuko? The naughty me came out and said, no, Seth Mazibuko is not around. Seth Mazibuko is out in town working. And can I tell you that if my little brother wasn't there in the bedroom, they went to my little brother. Hey, where's Seth Mazibuko? Where's Seth Mazibuko? Oh, shame. Oh, no, God. Oh, no. And my little brother just went pointing at me just like that. And grabbed me, tortured me, and took me to the SANDF van.
Seth isn't the only one going through this ordeal. In the months that follow, similar scenes play out at other homes in Soweto.
I was arrested at night at my sister's house. We had in the middle of, not actually quite night, I think it was at dawn.
Sibongile Mkabela is just 18 years old when police break down the door of her sister's home where she has been hiding.
Early hours of the morning, when the police kicked the doors and they were looking for me, and I was right there. You know, it's just right there. But I remember their surprise, because I think in their mind they expected this to be driven by much older people. And when they found a young girl, they're like, is this it? Is this the Sibongile we're looking for? You know, almost to themselves, let's get serious. Are we looking for children here? Are we looking for adults who are organizing a march of this magnitude?
This is where our story starts, because we're talking about an iconic site in Johannesburg that is linked to these two stories and so many others. We're talking about Constitution Hill, once a dark and terrible prison in Johannesburg, but today, the home of South Africa's highest court, the Constitutional Court. In order to understand that modern-day miracle, you first have to understand the stories that unfolded around it. The march that both Sibongile and Seth helped organize is one of the most tragic yet pivotal moments in South Africa's history. You might know it as the Soweto Youth Uprising, a series of demonstrations by hundreds of school children in the township of Soweto in June 1976 that quickly led to anti-apartheid demonstrations around the country. On June 16th, the first day of the protests, apartheid police opened fire on the protesting children. These children were marching in defiance of the apartheid system of racial segregation, and specifically against being made to study in Afrikaans, the language of the oppressive government. The brutality of the apartheid police that day shocked the world and ultimately galvanized the movement against apartheid both locally and internationally. So how did Sibongile and Seth, both teenagers at the time, end up helping organize this historic protest by hundreds of school children?
I think for me, I always say there is no moment. There is no moment of decision. The moment of decision is probably my entire early childhood and early life. I grow up in a place that would probably, in today's language, which is not very helpful, be called amongst the poorest of the poor.
I grew up in an area called Orlando East, in a family staying in a small two-room house. And when I say two-room house, I do not even mean two-bedrooms house. I mean there were only two rooms, my parents' bedroom and a kind of a kitchen, coom dining room. And believe you me, we stayed as a very big family of about 13. There were my aunts and their children and my parents and my siblings.
In 1976, Soweto is at the center of resistance against the apartheid regime. Both Seth and Sibongile enter their teen years at a time when the teachings of black consciousness leaders like Steve Biko have taken hold. And so, when the apartheid government decides that the language of Afrikaans, a language children in this community neither speak nor understand, should be the medium of instruction in their schools, there is no chance that they or their classmates will quietly acquiesce to this unfair demand. In their minds, education is their best chance of rising above their circumstances.
We were students and children who were going through a pain of having to be taught under a system of education that was seeking and purposed to making us, subservient, into it was a system of education that was seeking to make us better domestic workers, better gardeners.
But when we start off, we are completely innocent. We are almost jovial in the manner in which young people and children would be. We're taking care of one another. As we left our school, I left Naledi High School and being one of the leaders of this march, having organized all the other students, we live with an awareness of one another. And as a rule, we say, make sure that you're holding somebody's hand all the time as we march, so that we are accountable for the child whose hand you are holding, or the friend whose hand you are holding.
The police shot tear gas canisters to students in the corner of Muwema Street and now Vilakazi Street. The God of Africa was with us, because what happened is that the fumes and the smoke of the tear gas canisters was blowing back to them as the police. Behind them, another group of students was coming. I think it was Smongle's group and demonstrators that came from behind the police. So they felt like we're sandwiching them. And this is the time in which they started shooting like bullets. And this is the time in which we started counting corpses. We started seeing the Hector Petersons, the Hastings Ndlovu, and many other young people being shot and killed. Now, the pain that I still live with is the pain of having led black children out of the classrooms to be killed by their fathers the way they were killed. I can't get that out of my mind and my heart and my eyes, and it lives with me.
It is a complete turning point for me personally, a complete turning point, because I was at that meeting that organized. There is a level of, there's a part of you that feels a sense of not guilt somehow, but not quite, because there was no regret, but a sense that we can't go back. We've gone too far.
More than 100 people are killed in the confrontation. the actions of the police spark an international outcry. But in South Africa, authorities turn their wrath on the organizers. They arrest a group that's dubbed the Soweto 11. Among the 11 are Seth and Sibongile. They're just teenagers when they're taken to a notorious place to await trial. It's an old prison on a hill in Johannesburg. It's known as the Old Fort.
So from the time you walk in, you know, the front door, that huge wooden front door, and that door opens. It opens as if it's going to open into something really bad.
In the 1970s, the massive wooden doors of the Old Fort did indeed open into something bad. Quick history lesson. The Old Fort is almost as old as Johannesburg itself. It was built in 1893, originally as a prison to serve Johannesburg, then a fledgling mining town. At first, only white men are detained here. But over time, the number 4 and number 5 jails are added for black men, and the women's jail is added for female prisoners. Today, more than 4 decades after she was marched through these doors in 1977, Sibongile Mkabela still struggles to talk about her time there.
You know, I haven't spent a lot of time on this. I haven't spent a lot of time reflecting on those days. Maybe there's a part of me that says, that happened. It happened. It's a fact. And you move on. But you move on with what is left in me is the determination. Determination to change and for change. And I think that has stuck with me.
That these memories are traumatic is little wonder. There are very few records about life in the women's jail during this period. But fortunately, one prisoner who spent 113 days at the women's jail in the 1970s documented her time there meticulously.
The cell was small but clean. There was drinking water in a small round stainless steel receptacle, and a small pail served as the toilet.
Renowned liberation movement leader Fatima Mir, who was imprisoned here in 1976, published a book detailing her time in prison at the Old Fort. And here's an excerpt from the book Prison Diaries, read by her daughter Shinaz Mir, who went on to become a judge.
There were 2 sleeping mats on the floor. It was midwinter and very cold. The cell felt colder. I was exhausted and had developed a splitting headache. I lay down on the mats and covered myself with my coat. The cold from the floor penetrated through the mats and felt as if it was biting into my very bones.
Perhaps the starkest moment in the book is when teenagers arrested in 1976 are brought into the prison.
Wednesday, September 29, 1976. At the end of September, a group of teenagers, mere children, were detained in adjoining cells. That evening, as we were locked in our cells, we heard the 13-year-old cry. The crying grew louder and louder and increasingly bitter. It seemed to us that at any time, Baleka's heart would break. We agonized in our helplessness. I do not know when I fell asleep, but towards morning, I woke up to the terrible sobbing of little Baleka locked up by herself. She was calling for her mother and for her home. We called to the child in consolation. 15 minutes or half an hour later, spent from crying, Baleka became quiet. Outside, the cock crowed and the birds sang happily. Baleka, I am certain, did not hear them. She wanted to go home. A child is teaching us to protest and has jerked us out of the way we accommodated our imprisonment. It is no place for her. It is no place for us. Baleka must go on crying, for crying is terrible to hear. It tears the silence and wings the conscience. I'm dying. Let me out, Baleka pleads in Sotho through her tears. Mother, oh my mother, I am dying.
Along with many others, Fatima Meer was imprisoned with Winnie Mandela, the charismatic wife of anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela. Meer and Mandela and other activists were able to draw solace from each other to bear up under the harsh conditions.
We are no longer in parda from each other. Our conditions of detention have changed. We are no longer in solitary. There is jubilation all round. We laugh away our imprisonment, sing it away, dance it away. We read, discuss, and write down our thoughts as I do now.
But not all prisoners at the old fort were activists. In fact, although prison records are scanty, the vast majority of prisoners who ended up here probably did so for falling foul of the unjust apartheid-era laws, including the infamous pass laws. Now, the pass laws decreed that black people needed a document, basically a racial passport, that strictly controlled their movement. Being caught without a pass or being caught in an area not covered by a pass was an instant ticket to jail. In other words, these weren't people committing what you or I would recognize as a crime today. There were also some notorious criminals held here. Ever heard of Daisy de Melka? Now, she's believed to be South Africa's first woman serial killer. Her three victims were two husbands and her son. She murdered them between 1923 and 1932, lacing their food with poison. She would have got away with it too, if the brother of her first victim hadn't noticed the eerily similar ways in which all three men died and flagged it to police. A fearsome South African prison gang still active today is the Numbers Gang that was born in the overcrowded cells of the old fort. And this secretive, brutal gang has been linked to murders, rapes, contract killings, and drug trafficking in South African prisons. It's also one of the oldest gangs in South Africa. The story goes that one of the gang's founders was a would-be mine worker, lured away from the mines to become a highway robber. He was arrested for this crime and served time at the old fort. But most of the prisoners here aren't highway robbers, serial killers, or even activists.
The majority were a woman who came from Kwadlangezwe looking for a husband and overstaying her welcome in Johannesburg and being arrested and put. Those women that I met, or I saw as I walked into the, first time I walked into the prison, into the old fort, those women who were, not many of them, for no particular reason, were there purely because they're black, they're the wrong place at the wrong time. And I feel that many of those women's stories have not been told.
Well-known political prisoners had a sliver of protection in that their arrests were widely reported in the media, and so their disappearances would be noted. Indian civil rights leader Mahatma Gandhi served time here 70 years before the Soweto riots in 1906, and it's here that most historians believe he was introduced to a simple cap that all black prisoners were required to wear in the prison. It made an impression on him. And so, the famous Gandhi cap was born, which became an iconic part of the dress code of freedom fighters in India. Nearly half a century after Gandhi, Nelson Mandela served time here twice. South Africa's most famous son, who would ultimately become South Africa's first democratically elected president, was first brought to the old fort in 1956, when he was arrested with a group of more than 150 activists who were accused of treason against the apartheid state. He was held in a communal cell with other activists. Decades later, in his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, he would say this cell became a convention for far-flung activists, allowing them to catch up with each other after months of being banned and in hiding. Authorities very likely took note of this, because when he was arrested again and brought to await trial here in 1962, he was kept in the prison hospital in the old fort, the part of the prison reserved for white male prisoners. From this point on, Mandela was transferred to Pretoria and then Robben Island. He would not see freedom for 27 years. But, well known or not, all prisoners were subjected to the same dehumanizing treatment. Seth Mazibuko.
I was detained under Section 6 of the Terrorism Act. And what we went through, it was a painful one during the time. And, you know, you will be kept in solitary confinement. You will be, you know, I mean, I always say this, that now even when we're in detention, flies and ants were big friends. You'd literally, you know, to drop some coffee on the floor so that now you must make sure that there are ants that will keep you going for a day.
After awaiting trial in solitary confinement for about 18 months, Seth becomes one of the youngest prisoners to be sent to Robben Island, where he serves a 7-year sentence. Sibongile is given a 3-year sentence, which she serves in Pretoria. 4 decades have passed, but she still thinks about the other prisoners.
But I'm always curious about how the women who were there always reached out to, at least to me. I was on my own. So they always reached out to me. They always sneaked something or the other to make my life a little bit better. They were always trying to tell me what's going on, what's happening in the prison, and I was interested in their stories. They didn't have much time because they really didn't see me. I had contact with a little bit of them when they bring me food in the morning. And most of it is really thrown on, you know, on at the door. And you're lucky if someone says, hi, hello, can I say hello to you? You're lucky if someone comes closer and is curious about who you are and wants to know more about you. And it's that curiosity that says, you know, the people with whom we walked this journey are part of this journey.
In 1983, the Old Fort prison is shut down. Prisoners are moved to another larger facility in Johannesburg, and the site is largely neglected. In 1990, Nelson Mandela walks out of prison. 4 years later, in 1994, the country's very first democratic elections are held. And in those few first years of post-apartheid freedom, a compelling new document is written to set the country on a new path. That document is the South African Constitution, signed into law by Nelson Mandela in 1996. And what does it have to do with the prison on the hill? Everything.
And I must tell you, it was, you know, the way that the court is built, it's very hard to not hold an opinion, to be ambivalent about it.
Luanda Kaso wasn't yet born when Sibongile Mkabela and Seth Mazibuko endured solitary confinement at the Old Fort in the 1970s. But, like them, Luanda has spent about a year in the prison on the hill in Johannesburg. Also like them, she has spent her time in this place fighting for human rights. Fortunately, unlike them, she does not experience torture, degradation, or solitary confinement here. You see, Luanda was not a prisoner at the Old Fort. She was a law clerk at South Africa's highest court, the Constitutional Court.
For me, you know, being a law clerk at the Constitutional Court is something I could never have fathomed the gravity of at that time. The fact that we have this court is beyond, you know, my understanding of how it actually came to be. When I stand in that courtyard, I think the history of South Africa really hits me.
President Nelson Mandela appoints the first justices on the Constitutional Court in 1995. Among them is Justice Albie Sachs. Sachs was targeted by the apartheid government in a car bomb attack in 1988. He lost an arm and his sight in one eye. As one of the first 11 justices on the Constitutional Court, his first job was to help find a permanent home for the court, which was operating out of an unremarkable office building in Braamfontein. Sachs has shown many sites across Johannesburg, and nothing really feels right until...
And eventually we were shown the Old Fort prison. It was overrun with weeds. It was decrepit. It had been decommissioned a number of years earlier as a prison. And immediately, Anfrithla and I knew straight away, this is where the court has to be. But mainly because of its history. That had been the place of domination and control. And somehow transforming that pain, the oppression, the ruthlessness, the uncaring spirit of the past into hope for the future would be a marvelous sight for the court.
And then came the monumental task of turning a prison into essentially a Supreme Court. A competition is held, and architecture firms from around the world vie for the honor of reshaping the space.
The entry by the architects from Durban, Johannesburg, who won the competition, had on its cover a black and white graphic work showing a team of people sitting around a table under a tree with the camera person with videoing the proceedings. And their theme was justice under a tree, and that theme runs right through the building. You see it in the light that streams into that space, and you see it in the general friendliness and openness of that sector. Similarly, in the court chamber itself, there's lots of light that comes in, the implications of dappled sunlight on the carpets. It's not a severe space for justice to be conducted. It's a friendly, warm space.
The winning design is by two firms working together, Urban Solutions and OMM Design Workshop. And it's extraordinary. There is hardly an element in the court that is not meaningful. And outside the courtroom is an art collection that is equally extraordinary, symbolizing South Africa's history, transition, and hopes.
And the net result is a building that I think is unique in the world for its warmth, for its intelligence, for its interest. Anyhow, for me, Albie, it was a total, total delight to function in that ambience. And I think it was also important for council, who instead of feeling we are now entering the court and we have to be stiff and self-important, feeling we're entering into the space as human beings who happen to be lawyers, who happen to be representing our clients, arguing our cases as well as we can.
The Constitutional Court has decisively shifted South Africa's laws towards the ideals enshrined in the Constitution, from abolishing the death penalty to legalizing same-sex marriage to ordering government to provide life-saving HIV treatment to those who need it.
At a law firm, you take a side and your job is to fight for that side. Now you're fighting for a fair outcome, and not just for those litigants, but for the country. And you are making law. Through this process, I've learned a lot sitting at the feet of Albie Sachs, Joyce Siroke, Cheryl Carolus, you know, because I'm part of the generation that was given the Constitution and told, just live out your dreams. Hence, I've got 3 degrees and all these things that I indulge myself in, that now is really the time of thinking, what are we doing for others?
Now, one thing she does exceptionally well is getting others to connect with Constitution Hill's extraordinary story.
Going on a tour there with Luanda, and she just started unpacking some of the issues around, you know, the things around the art and the things around the design.
You may not be familiar with the name Robbie Brosen, but chances are you have probably heard of the enormously successful Portuguese-style chicken restaurant chain he co-founded, Nando's. Brosen toured Constitution Hill a few years ago, and he was shaken.
And suddenly I started realizing how inclusiveness and diversity and how that has been built into the design of the court. I left there almost giddy with like this feeling of complete disgrace for myself for not knowing the real history of the place, and why didn't you know what was going on there, kind of thing. And then the kind of optimism of the future.
Brosen is one of the trustees on the Constitution Hill Trust, the body charged with ensuring that the enduring message of the site is never forgotten. He sees Constitution Hill as a source of inspiration for creatives.
And if you walk on the hill and you meet some of the people that are getting inspiration there, that are hanging out there, it's some of South Africa's best young creatives. I've met, these are going to be South Africa's greats, and they're all world class. And that to me is what the Hill and the energy of the Hill stands for.
From its history as a prison, to its present state and bright future as a guiding light for South Africa's democracy. Constitution Hill has always been about one thing, the quest for freedom, equality, and dignity. Brosen's favorite part of Constitution Hill is the flame of democracy that burns constantly in front of the moving preamble to the Constitution. Words that seem to say that no matter the twists and turns of history, our course is set.
We, the people of South Africa, recognize the injustices of our past. Honor those who suffered for justice and freedom in our land. Respect those who have worked to build and develop our country. And believe that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in our diversity.
We therefore, through our freely elected representatives, adopt this constitution as the supreme law of the republic, so as to heal the divisions of the past and establish a society based on democratic values, social justice and fundamental human rights, lay the foundations for a democratic and open society in which government is based on the will of the people and every citizen is equally protected by law, improve the quality of life of all citizens and free the potential of each person, and build a united and democratic South Africa able to take its rightful place as a sovereign state in the family of nations. May God protect our people. Nkosi Sikelele Afrika, Morena Buluka Sechaba Sa Yesu. God seeing South Africa, God bless South Africa, Mudzimu Fatithetsa Afrika, Wosi Katekisa Afrika.